Accession number 29054, Mr. Bin Wells, Reel 6. Now, how did the training develop then? You started to use oxygen masks when you go high.
We started doing torpedo runs on a stationary target.
Now, tell me, how do you do that? I mean, tell me, what's the skill of taking an Avenger in on a torpedo run?
Well, they did a lot of exercises for a start on the ground, as it were. Unlike a tennis court area, we were given these like little scooters which you sat on, and you could manoeuvre these little scooters, and they had a thing on it where you pressed a button, and what would normally have been a torpedo came out of the bottom of this trolley. And another part of the thing was a thing which was a ship, really, which was going on a sort of straight course, and the relative speed of the ship was obviously a lot less than the scooters we were on. And as you say, you release this torpedo thing out of the back of this trolley, and you either got a hit on the ship or you didn't.
So you had to allow for the relative speed of the torpedo and the fake torpedo and the ship.
That's right.
So it's a sort of deflection shooting you were getting used to.
And they had another building where, like an enormous thing, like this thing they've got in London where they have all the stars and that. And in the middle of this thing was a link trainer, and you were in this link trainer. And then on the wall, it was a circular building, they flashed up pictures of ships, and these ships got nearer and nearer, and you had to manoeuvre this link trainer, and then again press a button when you thought it was right to release the torpedo, because you'd obviously got to aim off, because it takes so many seconds from when you drop a torpedo to when it gets to the path of the ship. So you've got to do this calculation as to how far you think you've got to aim ahead of the ship. And this was all recorded on the link trainer, and they could tell you whether you've got a hit, and whether it was plus or minus the centre of the ship, or whether you've got a miss, and how much you missed it forward or aft. So that was all part of this thing. And then you actually went out over the sea and did these torpedo runs on a stationary target for a start, and then as you got further on, you actually dropped a dummy torpedo on a moving target, and again they would tell you whether you got a hit or not. At the same time, you were also being trained or developed into doing dive bombing.
Now, how did you do with the time? I mean, all this training on the ground, and then you finally do your runs. I mean, was it reasonably easy once you had a bit of practice, or was it still difficult to hit even the stationary or moving target?
It wasn't that easy. I think individuals were different, but I think I got more hits than I got misses, certainly. And I found it most interested, really, at this stage that we also took on board a couple of American ratings who were air gunners, and we had to take them up for them to fire, because the Avenger had a rear turret, control rear turret, with I think 4.5 machine guns in, and we took these American ratings up, and they were firing both at drogues and ground targets as well. And again, I got on very well with these American lads, and so sometimes we were flying solo, sometimes we were flying with these American ratings who were training to be air gunners in the US.
Was it a two-man turret?
No, it was a one-man, but the Avenger normally has a crew of three. It has a pilot, it has an observer, which the RAF call a navigator, and an air gunner. And under normal circumstances, the observer sits behind the pilot in the canopy, and the gun turret is at the rear end of the canopy and is manoeuvrable, of course. But it was possible for the chap who would be sitting in what was normally the observer's seat to get into the rear of the aircraft and get into the turret, so they could change over.
Now, what about the dive bombing practice? Sorry, I interrupted you when you started telling me about that.
Yeah.
How did you do that? How did you practice that?
Well, you had a target. Usually it was on a small island off the coast, and there was a target on the floor, and you dropped these smoke bombs, small smoke bombs. You went into a dive, and the normal procedure was just before you drop the bomb, you pull the nose up and release the bomb, and if you're lucky, you get, you know, near the target. And you got quite good at it. I think these bombs that we carried were small ones, but they weighed 100 pounds, you know. And we were also introduced to sort of anti-submarine tactics as
now,
well.
Now, tell me about that, because we've not covered that at all. What sort of anti-submarine?
Well, that was on a moving target again. It was a towed target behind a ship. And you were loaded up with these 600-pound bombs, and you made an attack on this moving target and dropped these bombs on it. Now you either got a hit or a miss, you know, it's that type of thing. And so you were doing dive bombing, torpedo runs, gun strafing exercises as well, using these American ratings who were training to be gunners in the US Navy.
I presume you'd have your own guns as well, wouldn't you, in the wings?
Yes.
Did you practice them?
Oh, yes.
Tell us about
we've
that.
Got 2.5 machine guns in the wings, and again, we were able to fire those at fixed targets in the main, and I must admit that was pretty exciting. And also, as
well, how would you do it? Would you dive down or what?
In a fairly shallow, well, they used to call it glide bombing, in that you were coming in at a fairly narrow angle, rather than, I mean, when you actually do dive bombing, you're not quite as vertical as the old Stuka, but you're fairly steep dive. But these were, at this stage in the training, it was more as what they called glide bombing, which was coming in at a fairly narrow angle.
Now, anything else you were doing?
Well, we used to do navigation flights, because off the coast of Florida, you're fairly close to the Bahamas, and we used to do navigation flights over there. Of course, you're into the Bermuda Triangle, I suppose, when you get out there, and it was either shortly after or shortly before we were at Fort Lauderdale that these six Avengers mysteriously disappeared, and there's been all sorts of theories as to what happened to those six aircraft.
Did you know anything about it at the time? You know,
I don't recall that I did. I learned about it later, all these stories about this Bermuda Triangle, and it's perhaps as well I didn't know anything about it at the time. It might have frightened me to death. But so, you know, by this time, we also did some night flying, of course, at Fort Lauderdale.
What was that like?
I took to it quite well, I think. You know, it was sometimes over the sea, sometimes over the land. But again, there were no blackouts in America at that time, so there were various ways and means of picking up landmarks and so on. But the difficult thing about night flying, of course, is to get the aircraft down on the ground again, I suppose. But we had an American instructor who was an American lieutenant, and we had actually one American with our little group, And I remember we hadn't been at Fort Lauderdale long when there was suddenly there was a hurricane alert, and they had to fly all the aircraft out of Fort Lauderdale up to Georgia. But for some reason they wouldn't let the Brits do that, so we had to stay on the base, and they battened down all the hatches and so on. But at the last moment this hurricane veered north and missed Fort Lauderdale, thank goodness. But that was you know, another. So I was at Fort Lauderdale through July, August, I think about into September time, September of 44.
No particular instance, just a grafting, flying, practicing, all these things you've mentioned.
Well, yes, you know, navigation, gunnery practice, skip bombing, glide bombing, navigation exercises day and night, fighter evasive tactics. We got onto that as well.
And what about them? What were the main tactics employed?
To try and get out of the way of the fighter, basically. I mean, you couldn't throw an Avenger about that much because it was too big an aircraft. But the idea was to, when you saw a fighter making a run on you, to manoeuvre the aircraft so he couldn't really get into a position to fire at you for more than a second or two. It was not that easy, but it was all part of the training, I suppose. So. August, September, we were at Pensacola. I'm sorry,
Fort Lauderdale. Yeah.
Fort Lauderdale, and then when we got to the end of August, we had completed the course there, and we were put on a train.
This is in August, then, not right. Okay.
No, it's in. This is September. It was September. I think I. Yes, I completed the course. About the middle of September, I completed.
So where
the
were
course.
You sent?
We were then put on a train again, heading north, and we went right up to Maine, which is on the Canadian border. A place called Lewiston in Maine, and here
Lewiston,
Lewiston, Lewiston, Maine. Yeah, and here we were given a British observer and air gunner.
Now, what was this? Was this a U.S. naval air base, or what was
this? Was still a U.S. naval air base, at Lewiston. We had a New Zealand lieutenant who was the chief instructor, and again we still started off by doing the
now
usual.
You were given an observer, were you?
Yeah.
Now who was this?
A chap named Younger, Younger.
Remember his first name or?
Tony. He was a midshipman because he, like me, he was not old enough to be a subby.
Now, what was he? He was going to be your.
He'd been training, I think, somewhere like in the West Indies, and the air gunner I had was a chap named Stars, Starrs. He was a leading hand.
Yeah. Wait. Let's go through. So, what was this observer like? Let's go back to him. So, midshipman Tony Younger. What was he like?
Well, as an observer, he was very impressive as far as I was concerned. And we were sent out on these various navigation exercises, and he used to give me the courses to fly, and they assessed how good you were by how close you got to the the final target, as it was. And he came out with very good results, in fact.
What was he like as a man, as, you know, as a chap? Because, you know...
I got on well with him. I wouldn't say we were bosom friends, but I got on very well with him.
What was he like? I mean, was he noisier or quieter than you? Or
he's pretty quiet, really. Pretty quiet.
But was he older than you?
He was about my age, because, like me, he was a midshipman. So he was certainly about 19, I suppose.
Now, what about the rear gunner was leading hand Stars? Do you remember his first name?
I can't, because... he wasn't with me that long, and I then got a second one. Now, what was his name?
Well, what was Stars like, firstly? I mean, any good? Or do you remember him at all?
Well, I seem to remember he got into some sort of disciplinary problem. I can't for the life of me think what it was now, but suddenly... he was no longer my sort of air gunner. Whether he was sent home or what, I don't know. Whether he got into trouble when he went ashore in Lewiston, I really never did find out. But
so, who was your replacement?
I'm trying very hard to think of that, because it was quite a bit later. Younger stayed with me for a long while, and. In fact, he was with me all the way through to the Pacific. I think one of the problems with air gunners in the Avenger was, because this turret was a very small thing, if they were over about 5'8" in height, they couldn't get into this turret, so they were switched to another aircraft or something like that. And I think that was probably Star's problem.
What sort of thing were you doing at Lewiston then? You got your crew.
Yeah.
And what sort of training flights were you doing?
Cross country again. Sometimes solo, and usually with your observer. Although I do remember. One incident when we were at Lewiston where we were doing a solo cross-country flight, quite a longish flight, and when I got onto the final leg, we were heading towards mountains. I wouldn't say they were the very big mountains, but they were mountains, and they were covered in cloud, I decided that it was too dangerous to carry on, and one of my fellow pilots, we went up this valley and tried to find a gap in the cloud and see the top of these mountains and couldn't, so we turned back and we landed at a small grass airfield called Megantic. We went there for a bit and took off again and tried to still find a way through and couldn't. So we went back to Megantic, rang the Lewiston base up and told them that we had made a landing at Megantic and would return to base when the weather conditions improved. Now, Megantic turned out to be it was in Canada. It was part of the cross-country exercise, but it was in French-Canadian, and all the occupants of Megantic spoke French and no English. So I remember we decided we'd got to find somewhere to stop the night. We got the chap at the airfield to call a taxi, and happened to be a girl taxi driver, and we had a bit of fun trying to speak French to her, because neither me nor my friend were that good at it. We'd done a bit at school. Anyway, she had got a friend, and we had a date with them at night, and we went back to the airfield the next morning and got the aircraft out, warmed the engines up, and the weather had still closed in, So we spent another day and night in Megantic, and in the end, the New Zealand lieutenant came over in an aircraft, and he said, "You two fly on my wing, and we'll get you back." So he took us up through these clouds. He said, "You did the right thing if you were not sure in making this landing." And we were not charged with anything. We got back to Lewiston, and you know, that was the end of it. I wasn't given any discipline as a result of it, or anything in my logbook to say that I'd done something wrong, because they said you did the right thing under the circumstances. If the weather had closed in, that was it. So.
Now, anything else happened while you were there, or any other aspect of the training we haven't covered?
Well, we started doing a lot of what were called ADLs, which are basically ADLs, I think, it's ADDLS, is Assimilated Dummy Deck Landings. And we had, for the first time, we came across a batsman who was an RN batsman, because the American Navy have different signals to the Royal Navy and the batsmen who bring these aircraft onto carriers. So we started doing an awful lot of these ADLs. You either, I got a number of wave-offs for a start, and then I gradually got the idea. I can see I've got an entry in my logbook saying I did 8 ADLs and they're all okay, and I seem to have got the word, as I put it, you know. And
now, what's the batsman do? I mean, people don't understand that. What is it they're holding, and what are they doing?
They have 2 circular bats, one in each hand, and they give you a series of signals. The one which tells you if you're too low, another one if it tells you if you're too high, another one if it tells you, you know, you've got one wing up or one wing down by doing this sort of thing. And you've really got to put your faith in these people, I suppose. And so, as I say, we were doing an enormous amount of these ADLs.
And they're just on the ground, but they're pretending to be at...
Yeah, they've really got the runway marked out like the deck of a carrier.
But it is actually on, it is just the ground.
Yeah, and you've got grass either side. And then after we've done this, an awful lot of these ADLs, they say, right, you're going to do your first landings on an aircraft carrier.
Now tell me about it then. Who did you
Well, what we did was we flew, I can't remember how many aircraft we took, about 8 or 10, I think, and we flew down to Norfolk in Virginia to the American Air Base there. And the following day, we flew out into Chesapeake Bay, which is off the coast of Virginia. There in the bay is a small, well, it looked terribly small to me, aircraft carrier.
Remember its name?
I think it was the Smiter. I believe it was a Smiter.
Spelled like it sounds.
S-M-I-T-E-R.
Now, tell me about it then. So what do you remember of this first deck landing? It's a dangerous
business. I'm sorry, it wasn't the Smiter. That was another one I did some later. It was called the HMS Charger.
HMS or USS?
It was a British. It wasn't a fleet carrier. It was one of the smaller carriers, escort carriers. And I do remember flying out to Chesapeake Bay and looking down and seeing this HMS Charger, and I thought, Christ, it looked like the size of a postage stamp, as opposed to doing ADLs on an airfield. It suddenly looked terribly small. But much to my surprise, it was easier than I thought it would be. You know, the batsman did his job well, and I did 4 landings on this HMS Smiter,
Charger.
And I think I put in my logbook, it was easier than I thought. I didn't get any wave-offs. I did four straight-on deck landings, and I felt very pleased with myself after that. And we only did the four each. Each of us had to do four. And we then flew back from Norfolk to Lewiston. But by the time we got to New York, we had a message to say, because we were flying information on this New Zealand lieutenant, and they got a report that the weather had closed in at Lewiston, and then we were going to have to land at New York. And I was flying one of the aircraft, and I got a couple of the other pilots in the back. And we landed at Floyd Bennett Airfield, New York. I can't remember now how we found it or how we got down, but I landed at this airport, and we went into New York, which of course I'd never been to before, and we lived it up that night.
What do you remember of it? What was it like for a young lad, for a young pilot in New York then?
I went out to Greenwich Village because I think I may have told you I was a bit of a jazz fan in those days, and I knew that Greenwich Village was a hotbed for jazz, and I was told to go to a place called Nick's Bar in Greenwich Village, where there was this jazz group, and this friend of mine and I, we went out there, and we got talking to, there was a group of four of them, I can remember who they were. There was a chap named Pee Wee Russell on clarinet, Miff Mole on trombone, Muggsy Spanier on trumpet, and they were knocking this jazz out. It was absolutely superb. We went
Were they black musicians? Was it a black club? Or was this
No, they were all white, these chaps were. They were all white, Muggsy Spanier. And certainly Pee Wee Russell and Miff Mole were all white. I can't remember who the drummer was, but we went and had a chat with him, because Muggsy Spanier, he asked us where we came from, and I said Leicester, and he said, oh, I know Leicester. He said, the Monfort Hall. I said, yeah. He said, I'm going to bring a band over there after the war, he said. And I've got a thing in my scrapbook of this Nick's Bar, and on the back of it, I've got the autographs of Muggsy Spanier, Miff Mole, and Pee Wee Russell, and anyway, we had a super night, had far too much to drink, I'm afraid, and got back to the Navy. I should mention, took over part of a hotel in New York called the Barbizon Plaza, which overlooked Central Park, and they had, oh, I don't know, two or three floors there, and any naval personnel. It was given a name, HMS Saker, this Barbizon Plaza thing, and we were put up there, and as I say, we got back a little bit worse for wear, and we got on the subway out to Floyd Bennett Airfield the next morning, and they said the weather was still closed in at Lewiston, and we finished up having to go back to Lewiston on the train. I can't remember to this day how we got the aircraft back to Lewiston, but we certainly all went back on the train. And really, that I suppose was the end of my flying training in America, because shortly after that, about a week or so after that, we were shipped back down to New York